Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Zatarain's, now celebrating their 125th anniversary. From WWNO New Orleans, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. For 28 years, Cake Bread Sellers in Napa Valley has gathered a small group of chefs, journalists, and food enthusiasts for an intensive four-day seminar at the American Harvest Workshop. This fall, the Louisiana Eats team was invited to participate, allowing us to share this incredible experience. On this week's show, we harvest Chardonnay grapes in the vineyard, take a wine tasting class with Professor Michael Weiss, and create culinary magic with Chef David Slater of Emeril's flagship restaurant. We're taking off to sunny California on this week's Louisiana Eats. We'd been on the bus for about an hour when it pulled into Canaris, California on an overcast Monday morning. The members of the American Harvest Workshop filed out and went searching for coffee and breakfast, quietly eating pastries as they waited for their guide, Toby Halkovich, director of vineyard operations at Cake Bread Sellers. The sun was barely up, but it was the end of Toby's day. He'd supervised the overnight grape harvest and was looking a little weary.
We started picking here about 1 o'clock this morning. We night pick for several different reasons. This time of year, it's not unusual for the daytime temperatures to be in the 90s, 100 degrees. So the working conditions at night are much better. It's much cooler. We're usually 55, 60 degrees. So better conditions. The other thing is you saw our truck left a little while ago. Nice thing about that is we can have all this fruit into the winery before it heats up. And so less oxidization. Better fruit for better wine. And the other thing is also it's more efficient. If we can get the fruit up to the winery and they can start loading the presses 6, 7 in the morning versus 10, 11, we can get more fruit in through the day, which gives us more flexibility. It's just a win for everybody. So those are a lot of the reasons why we pick at night. You need your
jacket on. Toby's job requires a lot of skill sets. He's part farmer, part geologist, and even a pretty good weatherman.
Directly west of us is the Petaluma Gap. It's a low point in the coastal range, and it's actually straight shot right out to the Pacific Ocean. So that fog kind of comes, it pours right in through here. The fog does get all the way up the valley, which is part of what makes Napa Valley what it is. We get the foggy, cool nights. As it recedes, this is going to be the last area that fog recedes from. And so we're going to stay cooler here. It's usually 5, 10 degrees lower peak temperature during the summer down here versus, say, Calistoga. So it's perfect for growing Chardonnay.
Guiding us around the vineyard, however, wasn't the only thing Toby had in mind that morning.
We're going to make a little competition out of picking the grapes and see how quickly we can get through a ton of Chardonnay. So we do this every year. Usually do Pinot. Pinot clusters are much smaller, so these guys get a little bit of a break and that the Chardonnay picks much quicker. But we'll see. We'll see. Usually it's always fun to try to put them up against our full-time crew so they can see how quickly it really goes. Because I expect 45 minutes to get this ton with, I don't know, about 30 people here. Typically 8 guys will pick a ton in about a half an hour. So they'll move pretty quick.
As we walked through the vineyard, the big green clusters of Chardonnay grapes were impossible to resist. But not all of the grapes were green. Some shriveled dark grapes lay scattered on the ground. Toby explained they were infected with botrytis.
Botrytis is also known as bunch rot. It's a fungus. It lives on live tissue, so usually if a berry breaks, the juice will start to rot. But also any free moisture. Mm. So it does kind of give it a purple appearance.
Well, how do you tell if purple grapes have botrytis?
Well, that's the nice thing is typically it's gray when it's active, so you can see it. But most red varietals are not susceptible to it because they have thicker skin. It's primarily the white varietal. And then the other thing is most of the red varietals, we grow in warmer portions of the valley, less free moisture, less of a problem.
It's incredible how temperamental grapes are. The climate, the soil, the water, they all determine whether a specific grape will thrive or not.
So in 17 miles, we can grow really any varietal of grape there is. We can do it very well. And you look at France, you have to grow your whites, your Pinot and Burgundy. In Bordeaux, you see your, you know, your Cabernet and your Merlot. So you've got several hundred miles apart. Here we can do it within 15 miles. And actually, it's not uncommon to see one vineyard and have both Chardonnay and Cabernet on the same vineyard. We're pretty blessed in that regard.
A green tractor with three empty bins was waiting at the end of the aisle. That was our task for the morning, to harvest enough grapes to fill those bins.
I'm going to pass out the knives. Let's grab one and pass it along.
After speaking with the tractor's driver, Toby produced a basket of knives with scary curved blades.
Remember, don't bring this on the plane as a carry-on.
Since most of us had never done this before, Toby explained we should be looking for the rachis, the small intersection between the vine and stem of a grape cluster.
What you want to do is you want to cut the rachis kind of right where it's still green. The best way to cut is to get the knife behind the rachis and then roll it towards you. Just like that. It's kind of a circular motion. You don't want to just get in there and yank back, okay?
Okay. What I want you to do is I want you to count off 1, 2, okay? So, 1, 2.
As the sun started to come out, we broke up into two teams and got one last safety talk from Toby.
So the big things, though, one person per vine. Everybody should be working from the east side of the vine or the open side of the vine. Always know where your hand is. Always know where your buddy's hands are. Is everybody ready?
Yes.
One All right. person per vine.
We did give you orange gloves, so if there is an accident...
You'll see the blood come through the glove.
No, but if the finger does get detached, it's much easier to see with an orange glove on.
Okay, ones over here.
All right, ones. Yeah. Woo-hoo-hoo.
I never figured out if Toby was joking or not, but maybe that was for the best. Later, I asked him about using trimming shears instead, but Toby said they're actually more dangerous. I believed Toby. But I knew the minute I had that blade in my hand, this was not going to be easy.
I'm not getting it, man. This is really hard. It's hard and it's frightening because of this curved blade. I keep distinctly having the sensation I'm going to stab myself in the chest. I've never been so tentative with a knife. I'm usually really comfortable with knives, but this is frightening to me.
In fact, the only person who looked comfortable was Boston chef Daniel Bruce, who had done this before.
It's not my first. Not my first pick.
He and teammate Lisa M. quickly got into a groove.
I'm cherry picking. It's called cherry picking, so you pick the best clusters.
That's right.
I think you're ready to go. What do you think?
Yep. My second knife!
Look at this!
Here, will you take that knife away
from me? Okay, good.
Look at this. Three buckets, two. A few clusters over there.
No leaves. Great.
As the large bins began to fill up, it became clear that Team 1 had an unfair advantage. 20 minutes later, I was still having a hard time.
I mean, the grapes are gorgeous. It's really hard to do. I am not going to give up my radio career for grape picking.
Look at this, Michael. We're almost there.
Within a half hour, both bins were full. Our crew of 30 had done well, but nobody was going to be hired on for the grape harvest.
This group, they did great compared to most groups. Number one, everybody was safe. Everybody came out with all their fingers. We didn't lose anybody in terms of nobody's out wandering around the vineyard at this point. I think we've got everyone accounted for. In terms of volume, they did great, right in there.
We took a group picture, happily returned our knives, and that ended our careers as grape harvesters. I'm Poppy Tooker, and this is Louisiana Eats. And the heart keeps bringing you home to California, where the warm sun shines, California. After the grape harvest, Michael Weiss, the American Harvest Workshop's official wine educator, gave us a crash course in wine appreciation. In addition to being the former sommelier at Arno's Restaurant in New Orleans, Michael's been teaching wine studies at the Culinary Institute of America for 27 years. So get out those notepads, because here comes Michael's master class.
It's very challenging to put wine in a perspective that young people will understand, that it's not just something to get drunk with, but it is part of culture. It is food, and it can enhance the flavor of food. Something that is light-bodied would be like water. Medium body would be like bark soda. Full body would be like a pistachio milkshake, perhaps. Or you could say skim milk, 1%, 2% milk, cream, heavy cream. Body is not about taste, it's about texture. And it becomes an important part in giving a mouthfeel to a wine, you know? You'll know that a white wine with that gold color, probably some oak treatment, but just to make sure, where you're going to sense that on the roof of your mouth, you'll go, you'll hear people sort of doing that, clucking their tongue, because it dries out the roof of your mouth, those wood tannins. Whereas red wines are even more challenging to beginners, because they have not only the tannins and the body coming from the oak barrel, they also have it from skin contact. So you're going to feel that between your lips and your gums and your teeth. It's going to really dry out your mouth. Here's some clues in terms of how to approach wine and understand it and not be intimidated, because, you know, we don't worry about if we're buying 2% milk or if we're buying whole milk, assessing it and swirling it and sniffing it. And sometimes people are a little bit, you know, shy about expressing their opinions. So with white wines, when you see a white wine, you tilt the glass. It's good to hold it against a white background, like a sheet of paper or a napkin. And if the color is straw or fairly light, and you see a green tinge in the color, that indicates that that white wine came from a cool growing region. It's probably going to be lower in alcohol, higher in acidity, and light in body. Whereas if you see a white wine that's sort of a banana yellow or a light gold with some brass highlights, that's probably a white wine that's a little bit older or seen some oak treatment, you know, because it was breathing in the oak barrel and that allowed it to gain some color. If the wine is, you know, even darker than that, there's a chance maybe that white wine is too old. You know, it shouldn't be browning unless it's a Madeira, you know, where they're doing that on purpose, or a Vinsanto. So color can give the first clue for white wines. Rosés are really wonderful with New Orleans food. You know, there's a lot of situations, and also with the warm climate, where rosés can really be wonderful. And they're usually made by just taking the grapes and having a shorter period of skin contact than you would with a normal red wine. And not all rosés are sweet, you know, like white Zinfandel. There's lots of rosés that are bone dry, and again, are quite useful in many, many wine food situations. So again, the darker the color there, usually it's a little bit more full in body. And how could you tell that looking at a red wine? So if you had a grape type, such as Pinot Noir or Gamay with a thin skin, you hold that against your white napkin or your white piece of paper, and you're going to see a sort of cranapple, cranberry, red cherry color. And that indicates a wine that's not too heavy on the palate. If you see an opaque, deep purple or garnet, that's probably one of the thicker skin grapes like Cabernet Sauvignon or Syrah, Shiraz, same grape. So we can tell a lot by the heft or the weight of the wine simply by the color. And if a wine is older, then it will be, instead of one color, monochromatic, it'll be polychromatic. And you'll see that the older wines will have sort of a ring of onion skin on the rim and a deeper, darker red color in the middle. Smell. We could only really taste salt, sour, sweet, bitter, and something they call umami, the Asians do. So a lot of what we call taste is really flavors, and we can first discern them in smelling. Young wines have primary aromas. If I'm smelling perhaps like Cabernet Sauvignon, on the most planted black grape in the world, I'm expecting that I'm going to get black fruit flavor, specifically one from California or Australia, New World, maybe cassis or black currant. You'll get a little bit of that in the French version, but also with maybe a little bit more earthiness or black olives or Kalamata olives, maybe some mushrooms, you know. So we have an idea in advance of things that have typical smells and typical flavors and typical weight. Aroma is that primary smell of the grape, like the berries in Zinfandel or the cassis in Cabernet Sauvignon. And bouquet comes after the wine ages, either in barrels or bottles or both. So you really, you know, if you're in the know, you wouldn't want to say, oh, this 2013 Cabernet Sauvignon has a lovely bouquet. You might refer to it as aroma, and after it ages a while, it would be bouquet. So now we're ready to put the wine in our mouth. And when we put our wine in our mouth, you know, it's like listening to, you know, a great song, whether it be by the Neville Brothers or Dr. John or any other, Paco de Lucía or any other great musician, should grab you right away. And then, you know, you're listening to as a song develops, and maybe you're humming that song after you finish listening to it. And good wine should be like that, too. Sometimes that color and the aroma seems to be very promising, but it just falls short on the palate. There's no persistence. So what we want from a wine, whether it be champagne, white, rosé, or red, is we want that immediate attraction, we want that middle palate, and we want some aftertaste, that persistence, which is known as the finish. So now we've put the wine in our mouth. We sense sweetness at the tip of our tongue. Think about how people lick an ice cream cone. We sense sour underneath our tongue. As I mentioned earlier, the wood tannins would be on the roof of your mouth, skin tannins on your gums. So we can taste all over our mouths, but, you know, those are some things to remember. Again, how do I know the wine's high acid? Do I have to read a book? No, you'll feel that you're wet underneath your tongue. How I know the wine's full-bodied? Oh, the skin tannins are on the gums, and the wood tannins are on the roof of my mouth. So after tasting this wine, again, think about the aftertaste. Is it pleasant? How long does it last? A lot of my students confuse the fact that it's very alcoholic or tannic with being a long finish. They're not necessarily connected. So some of my favorite wines in the world are light-bodied Blanc de Blanc champagnes. They may be light in body, but you feel that generous, you know, attack, middle palate, and that aftertaste. That's a hallmark of fine wine.
That's Michael Weiss, official wine educator for the American Harvest Workshop and professor of wine studies at the Culinary Institute of America. For more tips about selecting and consuming wine with confidence, check out his book, Wine Wise, or listen to this segment again on itsneworleans.com. What is confit and how is it made? Stay tuned, and we'll be back with the full explanation. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen and Zatarain's. Here's this week's culinary quiz question, brought to you with support from Popeye's Louisiana Culinary Institute. What is confit and how is it made? Confit is a dish almost as old as mankind and also a cooking process. My French cooking teacher, Madeleine Kamen, explained that it most likely originated with the cavemen, who slowly cooked meat in rendered fat in animal skins stretched across a fire. In the Perigord region of France, where foie gras is made, there's always been an abundance of fatty domestic geese. These geese were slowly cooked in their own fat with a combination of brown spices for flavor and salt as a preservative before being stored in earthenware jars. The meat becomes incredibly rich and tender as it slowly cooks at a low temperature immersed in fat. A little bit goes a long way, so it's often used as a flavoring ingredient in dishes like cassoulet. Today, it's common to find ducks and chickens cooked in this manner on menus everywhere. Try this same process with sweet fruit, but swap the fat for sugar syrup and have yourself a delicious dessert. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats. In the life of great chefs, learning never stops. David Slater, executive chef of Emeril's Restaurant in New Orleans, had never been to Napa Valley before he arrived at the American Harvest Workshop. During his stay, David was one of five chefs expected to collaborate on a five-course wine-paired dinner for 70 guests. David was not only challenged to prepare an entree, but also volunteered to make appetizers for the guests. He was short on time and cooking space in the small, crowded kitchen, but he had access to some incredible ingredients. David looked at what was available and thought about two dishes from Emeril's restaurant that he'd never paired together before and decided to test his curiosity. The result? Delicious.
One thing we started doing a few years back was using the leftover duck wings to serve as a dish, because back then, you know, the only thing you use duck wings for were stock. And as a chef, you want to, you know, you need to find a use for everything. You want to use every single part of the animal and waste nothing. So I think it was Sandy Sharp at the time. He's like, hey, can you use these duck wings for anything? I'm like, yeah, you know, bring us the duck wings and we'll try to find a use for them. So what we do is we confit them like we would duck legs. We season them with salt, and we let them sit for a while, and then we just confit them in duck fat. So we preserve them that way. And we tried a few things. You know, we went trial and error, and we tried grilling them, we tried frying them, we tried battering them, all kinds of things. And the way that works best right out of the confit oil is right into some cornstarch and right into the fryer. That fat renders a little bit more. They get nice and crispy. And then we toss them in this sticky, spicy, sweet chili glaze that we make at the restaurant with palm vinegar. It's kind of like a sweet and sour sauce, if you will, but with a little more flavor. And I kind of wanted to serve them like buffalo chicken wings, so it was kind of an Asian version of buffalo. And I served them on a shaved celery and grape salad with some creme fraiche that we whip with blue cheese. So it kind of is like, you know, it's not the carrots and celery, it's grapes and celery that goes really well with the glaze. And the grapes go really well with the celery and with the blue cheese as well. And you just dip these sticky wings into the blue cheese creme fraiche, and it is incredible.
Well, you know, when you were at Cape Bread, though, there were all these time constraints. There were too many cooks in the kitchen.
Didn't make it out with those duck wings. We were literally, if I didn't have another 10 minutes, they would have been too tough.
Did you have to cook them in a comfy style ahead of time? You had the time to do that?
I made sure I had time to do that. And that was my first priority, because the appetizers, you know, those are things that we volunteered to do. Those aren't things that, you know, we had to do. You know, I knew somebody was using duck, and I was like, hey, you got any duck wings? And they're like, of course we have duck wings. So I made little drumsticks, and I confit them as quickly as possible, because they only had 3 hours to cook. And if you confit them, they cook probably about 2.5 hours. I sped up the process a little bit by putting them in the wood oven and cooking them at a little hotter temperature. And then when it started getting a little too hot, I took them out and put them back in the oven. Just in the nick of time, they were ready. The honey in Napa was incredible, so I wanted to use that. I love bagnacotta. I love, you know, the flavors. I love the melding of the garlic and the anchovy and the chili and the lemon and the herbs. It's an Italian dip for raw vegetables or whatever you want to dip in there. At the restaurant, we do a bagnacotta compound butter. So I was like, well, I'm going to make that with a little bit of local honey and chop up a bunch of local herbs and throw them in. And then I'm going to cook the duck wings after they're confit in the wood-burning oven to get nice and crispy, and then toss them in a bowl with that bagnacotta honey butter. And that's how I serve them. So I did bring this duck wing recipe back with me. It's not on the menu as of yet. We had a kitchen table last night that got to enjoy it with some local Lower Ninth Ward honey that this girl, Uznia, that works at Bacchanal, and I'll give her a shout out right now, that she farms in her backyard, and she actually has a beehive and farms the honey, and we were lucky enough to get some. So I've been adding some of that honey to our bagnacotta butter duck wings, and they are incredible. We had some razor clams last week, and I did that same bagnacotta honey butter with the razor clams, and it was just phenomenal. There were so many inspirations there, and it's just, you know, I just find myself wanting to use the freshest, best ingredients possible. You know, that's what California gave me. Closest to the source, the best quality you can possibly find. And, you know, we're lucky at Emeralds that we're able to use those products and we're able to buy them. And, you know, we're lucky to be able to cook them, and our guests are lucky to be able to eat them.
That's Lucky David Slater, executive chef at Emeralds flagship restaurant in New Orleans. For your reservation or to see if David's added the duck legs and bagnacotta to the restaurant's menu, visit emeralds.com. Bagnacotta literally translates as hot bath. Traditionally, it's used as a fondue dipping sauce for raw vegetables in the Piedmontese region of Italy. But in the hands of David Slater, it transforms into something beyond tradition. David's take on bagnacotta is really just a version of compound butter, easy to make, and something that you can keep stashed in your freezer to use anytime the mood strikes. All you have to do is combine 1 pound of softened butter with fresh chopped parsley, capers, garlic, and the zest of a lemon. Then add a small amount of chopped anchovies. But don't be afraid, anchovy haters. They're only there to add essential saltiness, and you won't taste anchovy at all. Take my word, it won't be the same if you leave them out. A little extra virgin olive oil and honey round things out. Then the bagnacotta is seasoned with salt, freshly cracked black pepper, and some chili flakes. Keep it in the refrigerator or form the compound butter into a roll. Wrap it in plastic and store it in your freezer so you can slice a few tablespoons off at a time. Whether you've got duck legs, chicken wings, or veggies on the grill, this sauce is going to rock the crowd. Just add a few tablespoons of the room temperature bagnacotta to a deep bowl and add the hot food right off the grill. Toss them together until everything is well coated and your dish is literally dripping with buttery goodness. You'll find David Slater's complete recipe on our website at itsneworleans.com. I'm Poppy Tooker, and Chef David Slater's bagnacotta makes for some good Louisiana eats. You might know Nate Winter as the Nola Pie Guy, a popular vendor at the Crescent City Farmers Market and one of the food producers with the Good Eggs Network. Nate's a graduate of the French Pastry School in Chicago, but to stay on top of his game, the learning never stops. Lately, Nate's been spending time in pastry kitchens around town and letting us go along for the stage. Our first stop, the kitchen of John Besh's prestigious restaurant, August.
Recently, I spent the day in the kitchen with my good friend, Chef Patty Stikinney. Chef Patty is the executive pastry sous chef at Restaurant August. After playing with a few easier recipes in the morning, we decided to tackle a dehydrated chocolate mousse. Chocolate mousse is something I know and love from my high school days, but a dehydrated mousse? This was something that was a little newer to me.
Well, you definitely never want to overheat your chocolate. So we usually tend to pull off the bowl of chocolate when it's about 75 to 80% melted, and then just let the residual unmelted pieces start to cool down the chocolate. Because when you overheat chocolate, you risk burning it, causing it to have sugar or fat bloom. And it affects also the texture of the chocolate in your mouth, as well as it doesn't set up as nicely. So now we can set the chocolate to the side for now. And we're going to start making the meringue with your egg whites.
Whipping egg whites can be really scary for home cooks. For best results, I suggest leaving your egg whites out uncovered overnight to dry out. If you want an extra challenge, try doing it by hand every now and again.
And we're looking for like a medium peak. Okay. We don't want it super stiff because we don't want to have like lumps of meringue that's not incorporated. So we want it to be able to fold into the chocolate nicely.
By now, our melted chocolate is cooling nicely. The next step is to fold the airy meringue into the dark chocolate in separate additions. Here's Patty's advice.
So whenever you're adding something that's light to something heavy, so what you do is you take like a quarter or a third of your meringue and add it in and really work it. You don't be afraid to like really deflate the meringue, because what you're doing is you're making this, the dense texture, lighter so that it incorporates better with the meringue. It's called a sacrifice.
So you have coffee, right? So when you add cream to your coffee, when you first add it in, it does that really cool thing where you can see like the cream actually diffusing into it. There's that mixture of colors. So what we're doing is we're making each addition before you would stir it. So you're still seeing the dark chocolate, the white of the meringues kind of incorporating into this really, really beautiful visual effect. And so before we mix it all into one color, we're adding our next addition.
My production cook Kira's mind just got blown.
So after our final addition, we have this beautiful chocolate mousse. Normally, this is where I'd call it a day. But today, we're throwing it into a dehydrator. To do this, you want to spread it about a quarter inch thick on a Silpat-lined pan. If you don't have a Silpat, don't worry. Parchment paper works great for this.
Patty, about how long do these spend in the dehydrator?
It takes at least 2 days, I think, to fully dry out. If we really needed to use it, we could probably use it within 24 hours. But I always like to just go ahead and leave it in there for an extra day to make sure that all the moisture, especially in New Orleans where it's so humid already, we really want to make sure that all the moisture gets out of there. And then we just pack it into airtight containers.
For me personally, I don't have the luxury of a dehydrator in my home or professional kitchen. So what other options are available?
You could do it in a low oven at home, like if you did it at like 150, 200 degrees and let it go for a couple hours. It'll dry out on its own.
Fortunately, we don't have to wait 2 days or even 2 hours to sample this thin wafer. They keep it on the shelves 24/7 at the Pastry Kitchen in Restaurant August.
So this is the final product. It's our dehydrated chocolate mousse. It reminds me very much of astronaut ice cream. It's fun to eat. It starts out crunchy, melts in your mouth.
And it's almost like a cross between a chocolate vanilla wafer and a chocolate marshmallow. And this is a texture that's almost hard to describe because it's not like well-tempered chocolate, but there is a snap to it. It's light and airy, but it's not silky smooth and creamy. It's just crunchy, crumbly that turns into this kind of melty, soft flavor. It's really, really fascinating.
Glad you enjoyed it.
What I love about this dish is that it takes the familiar chocolate mousse and reinvents it in a way that even I, as a pie maker, can use. I'm thinking maybe a crunchy chocolate mousse piece sitting atop a pillow of homemade whipped cream on a beautiful banana cream pie. See you at the farmer's market.
Nate Winter is a Shreveport native living in New Orleans. Find him at the Crescent City Farmer's Market or online at nolapieguy.com. Chris J. is an inspired food blogger for the Shreveport-Bossier Convention and Tourist Bureau. Chris is also our Louisiana Eats roving reporter. And Chris, you're back.
What are we going to do today?
We're going to go to Rhino Coffee in Shreveport's South Highlands neighborhood. This is a relatively new coffee house that's in a beautiful, beautifully renovated two-story historical home in the South Highlands neighborhood. And it's just such a cool, cool atmosphere. And they serve wonderful food as well.
Yum. So what do you eat when you go there?
Well, I would definitely recommend, and I know this is not what you're expecting from a coffee house, but they have a chef there named Pat Bowling, who is creating basically stews and soups that are really world class. Pat's sort of this like beatific guru type. You know, he's always in the back cooking up something. He'll come out, he'll give you a little taste, he'll put his arm around you, see how your day was. He's the same way with his customers and his staff. Everyone kind of breaks into a smile when they see Pat come out of the kitchen with something for him to taste or a joke about some guy that just left. He's a part of why I love Rhino so much. He is the fabric of the place. He's always talking about food as a part of his upbringing. And I think that that's the kind of food he's trying to put in front of his customers at Rhino. The beef stew marsala is absolutely fantastic. Chunks of beef, new potatoes, baby portobellos, celery, garlic. It just tastes like you're scooping out a garden with your spoon. It's really, really wonderful.
That's delicious. And what kind of soups do you enjoy?
You know, this is going to kind of speak to the comfort food junkie in me, but their chicken pot pie is fantastic, which is topped with a biscuit that's sort of cooked on top of the pot pie. The place has a romance to it. You feel like the wheels are sort of about to fall off, like the inmates have been allowed to run the asylum. It's all these like really attractive, sexy young hippies that are in the back concocting a vegan pizza that's going to be ready in 20 minutes. And, you know, you just shouldn't go in there with a plan. You should go in and just say, what the heck are y'all working on in the back? Because these creative, young, fun people are always cooking up something.
That is fascinating. So there's a pretty big vegan emphasis there, too.
Vegan and vegetarian, they realize that they're catering to an audience that hasn't really been catered to extensively in Shreveport-Bossier. And there's just like sort of a vibe there that they're going to do things differently than they've been done before.
What's the coffee like? Because, you know, if it's a coffee house, they must have some sort of trademark.
They do, absolutely. And I think their trademark is they care about the coffee they're roasting. They're making sure that it's fair trade. If you ask a barista about the coffee of the day, he's going to tell you where it came from, when it was picked, the name of the plantation or farm that it came from, and the origin, the terroir. I mean, they know this stuff. And that's why I feel close to Rhino Coffee, because you get the feeling that they're doing like something that's about ethics and it's about philosophy. And it's not just about putting a product out as quickly and as cheaply as possible.
That's a rare thing in today's world.
Absolutely.
Isn't it?
Especially in northern Louisiana, where coffee house culture really has been few and far between.
Charming. Every time we talk to you, Chris, I want to get behind the wheel and just drive north.
I appreciate it. I'd love to see you up there. I'll take you out to Rhino Coffee.
Chris Jay, our Louisiana Eats roving reporter. When we come back from a short break, we'll speak with Dolores Cakebread, co-founder of Cakebread Sellers. Stay tuned. Hey! I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Rouse's Market. The American Harvest Workshop wouldn't exist without Jack and Dolores Cakebread, founders of Cakebread Sellers. They've been in the wine industry since 1973 and played a pivotal role connecting Napa Valley's farmers and purveyors to chefs in the region and across the country. But they weren't always at the epicenter of America's most famous wine region. Before they founded the winery, the family operated another business, Cakebread's Garage in Oakland, California. On the final day of the workshop, Dolores reflected on her life as a leader in Napa Valley.
Cakebread's Garage was a family business. Jack's father had started it, and when we came home from the service, his father had a heart attack. So Jack had to work at the shop, which is not what we really planned to do with our life. So we both worked at the shop, and built it up to a really good business. We had wonderful employees. We had 11 employees down there. And it kept us really busy. But then when we started the vineyard, Jack said, Dolores, you know, you don't have anything to do, so you could go up and run the vineyard and I'll run the garage. So I came up here for about a month, and the workers would not work for me. Finally, I was really frustrated, so I went home and told Jack, and he said, Dolores, you're being ridiculous. I said, okay, you go up and run the vineyards, and I'll work at the garage. So Jack said, oh, okay, so I'll come up and do it. They wouldn't work for him either because he was a white gringo man from the city. And so finally we hired a manager, and he was from the valley. And so they were very happy working for him. So that took care of that. And pretty soon it turned out I was running the garage and he was just up here. So, you know, life changed every day.
I would like to know how you and Jack even became interested in drinking wine in the first place.
Well, back in 1966, we were invited to the Berkeley Society's wine tasting. Now, Jack and I had never been to a wine tasting, so we just went and we got to this house in San Francisco, and everyone was carrying their case with 8 glasses in it. We looked at each other and said, oh dear, I think we blew it. So we went in there. The hostess gave us 8 glasses each. Now, we weren't really big wine drinkers then because California had not come on board, and so it was just French wine. And they went around the table and asked each one, which did you like best? And Jack said, well, I like this one. And the name was Bechevel, but he called it Belchebelly. They thought, oh my goodness, you know, I could have crawled under the table. Anyhow, that was our introduction to French wine. Then later, in 73, the wine industry was just starting in Napa Valley. And we were able to buy this piece of land only because we thought it would be wonderful to bring our family up on holidays to enjoy the countryside. But as we got to looking around and we thought, maybe we should be something more, we talked to the neighbors like Robert Mondavi and Andre Chelichev, and they all said, oh, you should plant Cabernet. Now, Robert Mondavi said, no, no, no. You should plant Sauvignon Blanc because Sauvignon Blanc is cash flow wine. You can put it out in 1 year, whereas Cabernet takes 5 years to age. So we got to thinking and we planted a little of both. So we had cash flow and we had aging wine. Then we got all our friends together and had a bottling party. They helped us bottle our first 57 cases of Sauvignon Blanc. And that was so much fun. So we bottled the 57 cases, and Philip from Grötzinger Wine Company in Yountville came up to taste our wine to see if he'd like to sell it. He really liked it. He said, I'll take it all. And I said, well, you can't take it all because it's like selling your children. So we only gave him part of it. And then the rest I took in 10-case lots in my station wagon and went to Jackson Wine Company in Berkeley. When I got there, there was a beer truck in front of me. Here was a gal in jeans and tennies unloading these cakes of beer. And I thought, wow, that's not really what I planned. But anyhow, I went into the store and said, hi, I'm Dolores Cakebread. I have some wine for you. Well, they'd never heard of me or heard of the wine. So the guy said, put it over in the corner. I said, do you have a cart or something I could use? You didn't bring your own cart? No. Anyhow, he lent me a cart. I put it in the corner and got in the car and thought, oh, this is never going to happen to me again. So after that, I wore a flippy skirt and high heels. So they would say, oh, Mrs. Cakebread, can I help you? And I'd say, oh, of course you can help me. I'd love that. Thank you so much. So ever after that, they unloaded my car for me and put the cases in the corner themselves.
Yeah, I understand that your relationship with Jack Cakebread goes back to middle school. You all have known each other a long, long time.
He exaggerates. It was really high school, you know, and he gets his years mixed up, but it was really high school. He had a car, and that was the wonderful joy of my life. I met Jack at a dance, the first dance of the season, and we've been dancing ever since. Had a wonderful time. We've been married now 66 years, and we still love each other.
It's obvious when you see the two of you all together. Tell us, Dolores, about how it is to work in a family business with your sons. How has that been as they have grown older and taken a leadership role here?
Well, it's been very wonderful. You know, when you work with your family, you have ups and downs because one is really great one day and one is not so great the next, and the next is really down and out. And then that one is up on top. You know how families go. But when you're working together, you have to kind of not take too much of that to heart and smooth it over and make things work out. We all knew that we wanted to keep the winery in the family and not have any partners. So we've worked at accomplishing that. And they have their ups and downs like brothers do. But, you know, they're working it out and it's turning out very wonderful.
What do you hope for the future of Cakebread Cellars?
Well, you know, as owners and as entrepreneurs, it's very hard for Jack and me to give it up. And we need to face that sooner than later. But we started the winery. We have not had any partners on anything. It's been our entrepreneurship that has accomplished all this. It's just been a joy. So, you know, we come to work happy every day. Everyone's happy. Our motto is one heartbeat from the front gate to the back gate. You're all on the same page. You all love each other. You all work together. It works.
Dolores Cakebread of Cakebread Cellars. To see pictures from the American Harvest Workshop, visit our website at wwno.org or itsneworleans.com.
Fill your heart with love today. Don't play the game of tag. Things that happened in the past only happened in your mind, only in your mind.
That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Tune in next week when we celebrate Halloween with Shreveport's Zombie Food Truck.
Well, I've had probably about three or four encounters with people that think that this is maybe a satanic truck or something of that nature. I mean, I just don't judge a book by its cover, you know?
Subscribe to our podcast, hear today's show, or catch up on previous editions anytime online at itsneworleans.com. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Rouse's Markets, and Zatarain's. Additional support for Louisiana Eats is provided by Dickie Brennan and Company and Linda Green, the Yakaman Lady Soul Food Catering. Our media sponsor is Louisiana Life Magazine, the magazine of a great state. Original theme music by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes. Thanks to executive producer Thomas Walsh and sound engineer Joe Schreiner. I'm Poppy Tooker. We'll see you next time. Louisiana Eats is a production of WWNO and the University of New Orleans.